Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know the drill, we're recording on a very wet, heavy, snowy day on Thursday morning. And the only reason I'm giving you the weather report on the day that we tape is that we might actually lose connection to our electrical outlets because of this. We've lost it four or five times this morning, but there really is a heavy storm going on here, so please forgive me. We're going to continue in our Project 2025 discussion at the very beginning of this show. It is from an article by Ann Nelson. It's entitled Project 2025, The Latest Plot Against America. This is installment number 3. It is going to be brief, but I want you to hear it. Project 2025. This comprehensive 900-page playbook was produced under the auspices of the Heritage Foundation and supported by over 100 partner organizations. It's officially entitled Band-Aid for Leadership, The Conservative Promise. Project 2025 lays out specifics for hundreds of policy objectives affecting every area of public life, from women and the LGBTQ populations to environmental regulations to the concentration of power in the executive branch to promote an authoritarian regime. Here is the first of 10 things you need to know about Project 2025. Number one, it's not just about Trump. Project 2025 specifically states that it does not depend on a Trump victory in November. It's explicitly directed at the next conservative or the next GOP occupant of the White House. Since its donors and partner organizations have achieved effective control of the Republican Party through purging moderates and promoting their supporters, it is unlikely that any Republican candidate can successfully run without their support. So here's how Ann translates. Cumulatively, these organizations control massive voting blocks, concentrated among evangelical Christians, and coordinate extensive and carefully orchestrated disinformation media that spreads most concerningly across battleground states. And I also want to remind you that it's not just about Trump, but they've begun to implement it in states across the country. And when you recognize that the Republicans, i.e. the MAGAs, now control about 27 state houses across the United States, we're beginning to see Project 2025 coming into implementation in those state legislators with those state governors. So I just want everyone to know you're going to learn a lot about it. Take notes. It's already happening. Well, if it's Friday, it must be Texas. And if it's Texas, it's the Quorum Report. Joining us right now from the Quorum Report is the publisher of that fabulous project, and that is Harvey Kronberg. Harvey, and I want to remind everyone that not only are you the publisher of the Quorum Report, but the Quorum Report, and I looked this up quickly, is a nonpartisan newsletter focusing on Texas politics and government. It was founded in 1983. Boy, survival is amazing. And is Texas' oldest political newsletter. So welcome to the program, and thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. We had our 40th anniversary last year.
I got involved in state politics in 1984. So right around the same time as you were giving birth to the Quorum Report, Arnie was figuring out that she just couldn't get mad. She needed to get even. And the way to get even was to run for higher office. I'm looking at a number of issues, and I'm just going to throw them out there, and then I'm going to let you pick them in the order in which you prefer. We've been following a lot about the purging going on in Republican primaries, not just in places like Iowa, not just in places like Florida, but also in places like Texas. And you recently had a primary, but now there's going to be a runoff. And I saw this story and I was like so concerned, but not surprised. A conservative high-profile national group is once again entering the Texas House primaries. This time, Club for Growth is targeting Speaker Dade Phelan, who faces a runoff in May. That's one story. Texas law that would allow arrest of migrants has been argued in front of federal appeals court just the other day. And this is one we've been actually covering quite a bit of. UT student groups are left searching for money and support under the new Texas DEI ban, diversity, equity, and inclusion. And at least 20 UT employees linked to diversity, equity, and inclusion have been fired. This is another shocking one. Texas House GOP caucus dinner turns ugly as Chair Leisha presses caucus chair in awaiting Overson to support embattled Republican incumbents. And finalmente, Ken Paxton no longer faces a trial for securities fraud. What does that mean for Texas politics? He's become an increasingly powerful figure on the Texas and national stage. So I'm going to let you start wherever you want, but I guess I really want to start with Dade Phelan. because I am so concerned about what's happening. And I asked you before you even came on the air, Dave Phelan is the Speaker of the House. He's the one that led and supported the idea of impeaching your Attorney General for so many good and valuable reasons. And yet now he is under assault. Club for Growth is bringing in lots of money in a primary, in a runoff. And obviously they're targeting him. So my question is, why the hell is he sticking around? I mean, it's going to be so miserable because obviously he's probably not going to be renominated as the speaker. And the level of toxicity in the Texas House of Representatives is just going to grow increasingly horrible from my perspective anyway.
Well, first of all, I would point out that for Dave Phelan, this is a Texas Alamo kind of moment.
Right? Yes, it is.
This is the last resistance of independence or the last bastion of even quasi-independence in the legislative process. And this is an engineered hostile takeover largely by both Greg Abbott and Dan Patrick. Now, if Phelan does somehow survive and does become speaker again, he'll end up in some kind of alliance with Greg Abbott. But the bottom line is that Club for Growth, which has been a long time libertarian, arguably negative force in state, but focused on state politics, is putting $4 million into 9 primaries. And I'm presuming that or at least they say they are. And they started their television advertising on Monday in the districts. And they're essentially calling Dade Phelan a closet Democrat, which could not be farther from the truth. He's one of the most conservative speakers we've had. But the truth is always a first casualty in a political campaign. In these 9 primaries, at the moment, we think that 4 can hold on, including Phelan. And then we have this fellow named Oliverson, who's the neighbor for Dan Patrick. He's lives about 30 yards away. He's announced for speaker, and it is clear that he's a stalking horse for the purge. At the caucus meeting, one of the members got up and said, if you're announcing for he also has a conflict. He's vice chair of the caucus. The chair is running for Congress and resigned. And so he, all of a sudden, Dan Patrick supposedly has his plant in running the caucus. He was challenged at the caucus golf tournament, at the dinner, which usually is full of lobbyists, but this time lobbyists were excluded. But thank God for texting.
yes.
But one of the leading members of the independent Republicans I don't want to get too much into the weeds anyway, but at the end, when it's all said and done, he said to Oliverson, are you going to issue a blanket state of support for incumbents, even those Abbott are challenging, and will you raise money? To which Oliverson responded, well, of course I'll raise money, but I'm not going to issue a blanket statement. And the place turned into people yelling and screaming at each other because it was clear what was going on. And there was a couple of members humming Kumbaya off to the side.
Oh my God, I wish I was a little bird in that room. So as I'm listening to what's happening here, you mentioned that you think that Dade Phelan, despite the money that's going to be spent by Club for Growth, to basically unseat him. He's been around so long, he has such great name familiarity. I suspect that he will have support from the base, even in his district. But will he actually survive as speaker? Because what I hear is that Abbott went through and purged all the anti-voucher Republicans out of, or at least attempted to, out of the Republican primary. And as a result of that, has there been enough of a change in the nature of the Republicans that will probably get elected this November that Dade really doesn't have a chance to hold on to that position?
I would argue that that just about everybody has forgotten there's a November election, and that Abbott has dragged the party so far to the right now that you've got. Remember, Beto never did one commercial on Dobbs. Dobbs has yet to be litigated in an election in Texas, and Colin Allred will make Ted Cruz a referendum on abortion. My guess, based on the number of swing districts that I've looked at, or potential swing districts, is Democrats will gain between 6 and 10. If they gain 6, then it's an 80 Republicans, 70 Democrats.
Wow. And
the Democrats know that if anybody but Phelan is elected, or anybody in Phelan's cast is elected, they will lose the possibility of chairmanships. And so
Thank you.
what I think is about to happen, and it couldn't be more ironic, is that Greg Abbott will have purged the moderate, some moderates, mostly rural moderates, out of the Republican Party, out of the Texas House, but he will have given Democrats a gift of maybe up to 10 seats. And so the net of all of this violence being perpetrated on the Texas House of Representatives is that he will have elected more Democrats, and the voucher vote won't have changed one bit.
It's a chess game. It's just an amazing chess game, but it's one that makes so much sense. I mean, when we see what the consequences now of are Dobbs, it is horrific on every single level. And people keep thinking, well, it was only a couple of years ago, they've overturned it. But with each passing day, you're realizing the consequences of this, and they're getting worse. They're getting worse. They're not getting better. And I want to remind, I don't care whether you're a Hispanic woman, a Black woman, a white woman, anyone who has a family, that this really impacts you. And Democrats are going to run this up and down the flagpole. And of course, you're very, very lucky to have a U.S. Senate race. It's not going to be that Biden is going to be able to deliver the message. It's going to be the message that's going to be delivered in the Senate race, which everyone's going to pay attention to, since basically everybody like looks at Ted Cruz and rolls his eyes and says, "Are you a U.S. senator or a podcaster?" I mean, it's like there are so many stories coming out of Texas that just seem amazing. And I want to remind everyone something that is so interesting about Texas. Historically, it is not an unusual thing for Republican speakers of the House to appoint both Democrats and Republicans as chairs of committees. That is something I so damn respect. That doesn't happen in my legislature. Okay, we may only have two vote margins with Republicans who hold on to the speakership, but they've never made a chairman a Democrat. Never, ever. You know, and when I hear that, I'm in awe of that. But that's the history of Texas. And that is something that I think is so important for people to realize. This is not something that's new with Dade Phelan. It's something that has been historically done by most of the speakers, if not all the speakers of the House. And I just think that that is something to be valued and not to be marginalized.
Well, it makes consensus a whole lot easier, except on the really hot button cultural issues. One
Right.
more not thing to leave your listeners with, that may speak dramatically in this coming election. In 2012, Mitt Romney won Texas with 59% of 7 million voters. In 2016, Donald Trump won Texas with 56% of about 8 million voters. In 2020, Donald Trump won Texas with 52% of 11 million voters. The trend
Wow.
lines suggest that the bigger the vote in the president, which is obvious in the presidential year, with all the new population we're adding, that Republicans fare less and less well. Now, this is
Wow.
obviously a very different time. They're going to talk border. Democrats will talk abortion. We have no idea which one will prevail. But the trend line suggests that we are moving, in presidential years anyway, more and more purple.
That's an incredible number. Those are incredible numbers for people to hold on to. And again, I'm going to tell everyone, this is not a top-down election. This is a bottom-up election. This
That's
is not
right.
a top-down election. I am not going to think that Kamala and Biden are going to help me, okay? I mean, they're at the top of the ticket, and I'll vote for them. But that's not where I'm going to find my support. I'm going to find my support in my state. There are 400 legislators, 400. I'm going to look at them to fight like they've never fought before, because even in my state, there's now a war on abortion. Although we claim to be this libertarian state, but you know, compared to the rest of New England, we are very weak when it comes to that issue. I'm looking at all the issues dealing with public education. We too have a voucher problem here. So I'm just telling you that if you're going to look at what's going to happen at the top of the ticket, understand it is the bottom that is going to deliver the people, the votes, the issues, and that hopefully will trickle up as opposed to trickle down. And I think what you're telling me now is very exciting, because I think with the abortion story, that really will impact a lot of people at the bottom, as you point out in the legislature. But of course, with Ted Cruz running, thank you God, there's going to be just one more thing to add to this conversation. All right, so that is important. I want to talk a little bit about what just happened. You said you did not pay a lot of attention to the federal appeals court argument, but remind people what was being argued with the Texas law that would allow the Texas, you know, police and people within the Texas National Guard to arrest migrants. Explain to folks what the issue is here, because I think people need to understand the consequences of this. It involves the Mexican government, it involves the U.S. government, and it involves the Texas government.
Well, of course, you asked about last week when we spoke. You said, how come all of the action's focused on the border? And my point was that there are no cameras in Tyler, Tech, no TV cameras in Tyler, Texas.
Ugh.
But what the law does is allow a police officer, a Department of Public Safety trooper, anybody in law enforcement to determine at the time of the arrest that somebody has is there illegal is here illegally, and deliver them to the border for deportation. And of course, this is a function of the federal government, at least historically it has been. We'll see what the Supreme Court ultimately argues on this. I pointed out last week that south of I-10, they're very reluctant to do. I-10, by the way, is the sort of the highway that divides North and South Texas.
Gotcha.
I keep making that reference. In South Texas, they're reluctant to do it because they know there's going to be civil rights lawsuits, and one of these lawsuits could bankrupt a small county's entire county budget. So
Wow.
there's hesitancy there. But the reality is, if they arrest somebody and deliver it to the border, they have to be processed both on the American side and on the Mexican side. And both governments have said, we're not going there, we're not touching it, no matter what the court says. And so it really, but this was never about actually delivering people back to the border for deportation. It was about the optics of essentially a middle finger salute to the federal government.
Exactly. And I'm just going to read from NBC News just to sort of just refresh everyone. SB4 is Texas's controversial immigration enforcement bill. It's back in federal court. It was in court on Wednesday. Attorneys for the state, along with the Biden administration, were in Austin talking and arguing about it. What I think is really important is that it's before a three-judge panel. It's the same panel that put SB4 on hold for the last week while the case plays out. And I think what you're hearing now is that this is about optics. That's all this is about. This is not going to be enforceable. As you point out, both the American government and the Mexican government won't enforce it. It is about potential lawsuits. I mean, there are so many ripple effects to this, and it is not, it is only about doing what they always do. Focus on the border, whether it's real or Memorex. That's what they don't care about whether it's real. They just need to use the border at the beginning of the sentence, at the middle of the sentence, and at the end of the sentence, Harvey. It is
Well,
just
just to add one more
lacking.
thing. For Greg Abbott, our governor's purposes, it's been enormously successful in raising his profile. In fact, he just announced yesterday that he will be speaking in New York at their major Republican fundraising gathering that all the bigwigs will be at. And obviously, the fact that he's been able to back New York on its heels by delivering migrants without any preparation
Right.
and raising the costs. Has made him some obviously a celebrity in Northeastern politics.
Well, it'll be a celebrity in Northeastern politics. The question is, will it be good politics in November? We don't know.
Yes.
I mean,
Well,
that's the real question. And that's the test of your leadership, Governor Abbott. Anyway, the two other stories are actually their combination of two. UT students group left searching for money, support under new Texas DEI ban, and 20 UT employees linked to DEI are fired. So remind my audience, what is this assault on DEI and why is it having such major consequences, not only for these youth groups at this school, but also firing individuals. What was the thrust of this legislation?
Oh, it was a faux outrage over these universities being so woke. I call it faux outrage. Now, there are some examples, obviously, as we watch with the explosion of anti-Semitism after the Hamas. There's an argument to be made, I guess, but this is essentially about making the University of Texas look more and more like, or the all of the university systems. We've got five university systems look more and more like Texas, as you know. We are now a majority minority state. Anglos are increasingly in the minority. We actually crossed the threshold this year of having more Latino population than Anglo population in Texas.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. That that
Now,
that's a, that's a, that's a fascinating statistic. Thank you for that.
And anyway, so it's part of the national narrative to eliminate DEI. The University of Texas system is, well, the rumor was that John Sharp, the chancellor of Texas A&M, which is one of the most conservative in the state, got yelled at by the lieutenant governor for being so woke. But the bottom line, what you really have to remember is these are multi-hundred million dollar operations, if you're the chancellor or in this case, the chairman of the UT system, a former state senator, he'll hate it when I say he's a moderate Republican. For them, this is not an argument that they're worth falling on their swords about. They're trying to comply, and they're essentially getting ready for the Senate hearings in January of next year.
So tell me what you mean by impl I mean, here's what I'm trying to figure out. So what is it that they want to implement with DEI bans? Do they want to basically say that, every person of color is not going to be noticed as a person of color, everyone that speaks Spanish is, I mean, what is it that they are banning? I mean, do they want people to disappear? Do they want to, I mean, I'm just even trying to figure out how do you accomplish it when you're just describing that now, it turns out that the Hispanic community now exceeds the white community in Texas. What is it about this diversity, equity, and inclusion that they want to have evaporate when you're looking at a state that basically is about diversity and inclusion?
Well, obviously Republicans have had some success over the years in winning over Hispanics. For instance, George Bush actually got 49% of the Hispanic vote because he was very respectful
He was,
towards the
but the
Hispanic
operative word
community.
is he was respectful. That's the operative word by
Exactly.
Anglicanians.
Exactly. No, but this is the last gasp of an Anglo society, frankly, trying to homogenize and sanitize. It's a direct connection between the book bans. In libraries, to the elimination of diversity. There is a essentially white Christian narrative that we've talked about David Barton, folks who have alternative views of history that have been obviously sanitized, that this is a white Christian nation, and this is obviously the last gasp of that argument.
Oh, it's just
And
again,
we hope it's the last gasp of this argument.
exactly. But I'm just looking at the idea of, the abortion story is going to bring voters out in droves. Frankly, this assault on diversity, equity, and inclusion, as you just pointed out, how the numbers have now changed in Texas. I mean, I understand that there's a very conservative element within the Hispanic community. But in the end, here's what they can change: that they have. That they're swarthy, that they're noticeable, and that they will be identified. And nobody will ask them whether they have Republican leanings or liberal leanings. They will just look at them and they will target them. And if that's what they want, that's what you get with the Republican leadership. You get targeted. Not because of your views, but because you happen to, fit into this typecast that now is perceived as undermining, what do they see as an assault on white Texans. And I think that's what's so unfortunate is
White
that they have
Christians.
these leanings. By Christians. Yeah, exactly.
And
Sorry about that.
I should add one more interesting element here is that I haven't been down to the valley probably since before COVID, but people tell me that what there used to be a couple of checkpoints going heading south into South Texas, but now it's like every 10 or 15 miles. If you're a
Oh,
brown
God.
person, it's that your likelihood of being stopped is obviously increased. And the Texas economy lives on a very diverse population, and it's strangling it.
And again, I just, this is not about your political views. They are going to target you. They're not going to ask the question, did you vote for Abbott? Did you vote for Trump? They're going to basically say, show me your papers. I just want everyone to know that. That's what they're going to say. And unfortunately, even if you have GOP papers, it won't matter.
Right.
Okay? All right,
But
really
imagine
quickly.
having to carry being having been born in Texas and having to carry a passport.
That should be a documentary. I mean, all the things that you're talking about with the checkpoints and that you're born here. And then all of a sudden, because you're born here, you have to show a passport. We have to end with Ken Paxton. Like, talk to me a little bit about him because they're talking about his power has now significantly increased. And I'm just trying to figure out what does that translate into?
Well, his power has only increased inside the Republican Party, and people say the Texas Tribune used a headline declaring he was more powerful, and that's now become kind of the rubric. I claim that he's become more notorious, and inside what the current MAGA Republican political primary voter, he has his stock has gone way up. And remember, in a non-presidential year, the only election that matters is the Republican primary. So he's obvious. He's towel popping on Twitter. He's towel popping John Cornyn, senior senator from Texas, who is in
Wow.
line to be potentially the next leader of the Senate senators in Congress. He has gotten very aggressive on lawsuits, trying to reinforce the MAGA credentials. He still faces two more litigations, one that could put him in jail. The grand jury in San Antonio is still investigating. I know people that have been interviewed in the last 3 weeks.
Wow.
But the Merrick Garland DOJ has its hands full.
Yeah, with
I'm not
Trump.
sure how quickly that's going to happen. He still has the whistleblower lawsuit, and he's been trying to avoid depositions now for a couple of years. A
I need to
motion's
let you go. I need to let you go, Harvey. But
not
that's
here.
all. We'll get back to Ken Paxton, I'm sure. If it
Yes.
is Friday, it must be Texas. We've been hanging out with the publisher of the Quorum Report. Again, to remind you, the Quorum Report is a nonpartisan newsletter focusing on Texas politics and government, and it has been around since 1983. Thank you so much for doing this, Harvey. I really
My
appreciate it.
pleasure, Ernie.
All right, ciao. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude. Stick around, folks. We'll be right back.
This is Lincoln Mitchell with today's Mitchell Minute. A few weeks ago, Chuck Schumer gave a speech on the floor of the United States Senate. I thought it was an excellent speech. He told some important truths about Israel, about the war, and about Jewish Americans. And he also called for new elections in Israel. And because of that, he was met by outrage by some on the right. Now, obviously, this is a right wing that just kind of lives for the outrage, but they were saying Chuck Schumer is betraying Israel. Now, over the last few days, we've seen tens of thousands of Israelis calling for new elections. And the leader of the Israeli opposition, Benny Gantz, hardly a dove on this war, also calling for new elections. And the reason for that is that as the individual person of Bibi Netanyahu is the reason why this war continues in such a murderous and stupid way, and is a unique threat to the people of Gaza, the state of Israel, and the Jewish people globally, and is also causing the United States an enormous amount of, pardon the techno language here, souris in the region and indeed globally. So if you choose to think that Chuck Schumer, Benny Gantz, and the Israeli people are all involved in some anti-Jewish and anti-Semitic conspiracy, you are so deep into the bizarro far-right Fox world. But the reality is, it is past time for new elections in Israel and past time for Netanyahu to go and probably to jail. The Mitchell Minute is a daily minute or so of political analysis from me, Professor Lincoln Mitchell. If you want to hear more of my opinion and analysis, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel at Mitchell Minute, or subscribe to my Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now. And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors. When they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses. You've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know the drill. We're recording on a very wet, heavy, snowy day Thursday morning. If it is Friday, it must be Bill Curry. Bill Curry is an American lawyer and politician. He's been a two-time Democratic nominee for the governorship of Connecticut and a White House advisor in the administration of Bill Clinton. He was the former head of Freeze Voter, a nuclear freeze group. Welcome back to the program, Mr. Curry.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
And we always love hanging out with Harold Meyerson. Harold Meyerson is the editor-at-large at the American Prospect. He was an opinion columnist for the Washington Post from 2003 until 2015. He served as an executive editor of the LA Weekly from 1989 through 2001 and continues to write about California politics. And I want to welcome him back to the program as well. Thank you, Harold.
Always good to be here, Arnie.
This morning, I decided that I needed to sort of start with an article that I saw actually at the Union Leader, believe it or not. But it was looking at how many billionaires there were in New Hampshire. Of course, New Hampshire being the seventh richest state in the nation and being neurotic about the fact that wealth is the only thing that defines anyone in the way of success. I was not surprised that they would comment on the Forbes list of billionaires in the world. And so I want to share these two statistics with you. So I looked at the Forbes list and I wrote the following on my Facebook page. So, like, what is an economy for? And then I wrote, the Forbes 2024 list of billionaires is showing a record 2,781 billionaires. And I said, and of course, in the USA, it appears that the number one country on the planet for billionaires is us. I think we have 870 billionaires. But what I thought was absolutely fascinating was not only that we were number one in the number of billionaires, but that they were also collectively richer this year than they were last year. They were worth, now listen to this number, you guys, they were worth $2 trillion more. Not that they were worth $2 trillion. They were worth $2 trillion more. And I was like, okay. And of course, being the girl in this crowd, I also looked and they said women are still underrepresented, accounting for only 13% of billionaires worldwide. So I just thought that was interesting. And then I asked that question and I wrote, like, what are billionaires for? What's an economy for? And as I was asking that question, Bill Curry, here's what I did. I'm like, so how's the middle class doing in America? You know, just kind of curious. If all these billionaires are so wildly successful, and we now know that they've made trillions of dollars more, I found this out from Pew. The U.S. middle class has been shrinking over the past 50 years. About 50% are now called middle class in America, compared to what? 61% in 1971. So with that as my opening salvo, Mr. Curry, I keep asking the question over and over again, what is a great economy for? Because if the middle class is not being served and they're shrinking, and we're seeing the cost of everything that goes into that sort of market basket of needs, you know, housing and healthcare and food getting more expensive, and we keep gloating about the fact that we have a good economy, I keep putting my middle fingers up in stereo and I'm going, really? If the billionaires are doing so incredibly well, I suspect that means the rest of us are not. So, Mr. Curry, please weigh in.
Well, first of all, I would just like to say that unlike you two radicals, I'm happy for these billionaires. You know, I don't know if you knew this, but this stuff apparently trickles down, okay? You just have to be very, very patient. But my fingers are crossed. So I think the most important thing to remember about this is that the principal observation made by the right is that this is all the result of natural market forces trending toward globalization and financial integration, et cetera, unfettered free trade, which they say means maximizing the economic advantages and strengths of various localities. It really means corporate predators scouring the world for low wages and weak governments. And that's what free trade is. And that above all, it represents not any natural evolution of any market, but a set of political choices that we have made that we can unmake. If we wanted to, we could continue to subsidize public universities at the higher rates that we once did and make higher education truly affordable. If we wanted to, we could at least do a public option, which would drive down costs, let people who want to join federal system at much lower rates and begin to finally drive down costs of healthcare in the United States. To say nothing of going to a Medicare for all system. There are answers like this in every single area. We could bring down energy prices. We could bring down the price of consumer credit. Again, educating people that there are choices we can make and that these problems that seem so intractable really aren't. Or if they're intractable, it's not because of their complexity. And it's not because they arise naturally from complex systems. It's because our lobbyists and corporate-owned Congress keeps making the wrong choices. The right choices themselves are clear. The intractability is simply the political dimension of it. It's politically hard, but that's the only way in which it's hard.
So as I'm listening, Harold, to what Bill just said, I wrote down low wages, weak governments. And I'm thinking, oh, we're still at $7.25 an hour. Oh, and Donald Trump, he wants an authoritarian system where it will be a weak government because it'll be a weak government for us, but not for the fascists in charge. Okay. And that is absolutely what the corporate society is going to like embrace. And yet I keep thinking about the numbers of billionaires and that story about the middle class. And Bill said he really wanted to focus on an article at the American Prospect. And this is your magazine, so I'm going to talk about it. It was by Robert Kuttner, Harold, and it was entitled "Liberals Need to Be Radical." The agenda for Biden's next term must go deeper to restore the American dream. And I think really the story of the billionaires and the middle class is really about the story of the erosion of the American dream. The American dream wasn't to become a billionaire. The American dream was to have a house with a picket fence and your kids would be better off than you and they might be able to go to college and you might have a car in the driveway. You might have a good job and could take a vacation to Florida. I mean, let's talk about what the American dream was. And it wasn't becoming a billionaire. But yet when you see that erosion of the American dream and you see medical debt and you see student debt and you see all these things, you keep going, what is going on here? And I think Bill is absolutely right. We need to remind the American people it is about policy decisions. This is not a natural phenomenon of capitalism. This is about a bastardization of the kind of capitalism we've embraced. And it's about policy choices. And who is getting screwed? The middle class. They used to be 61%. Now they're only 50%. We need to drive that number home, but also explain how that can be changed.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember if it was Balzac who said, behind every great fortune, there's a great crime. But whether it was Balzac or not, the great crime, as Bill more or less said, is our politics creating this current state of, you know, massive upward redistribution of income and wealth. That's what it's done. You know, there was an equally, I'm glad you brought up this Forbes thing, because there was a Wall Street Journal editorial on Tuesday of this week that bemoaned the fact that a greater percentage of all the taxes, income taxes coming into the federal government are coming from the very rich. And the Wall Street Journal portrayed this as, the plight of the very rich. Well, that's because the very rich command, you know, a higher and higher share of the wealth and income in the country. A little consideration the Wall Street Journal did not take into account, nor did they do sort of the Warren Buffett calculation of the percentage of the very rich people's income as against that goes to taxes, as against the percentage of, middle class people and income that goes to taxes. I mean, it was the most intellectually the Wall Street Journal editorials are perpetually intellectually dishonest, but this one even stood out more. I think if you do look at the middle class and the population generally, one of the things that they support very heavily, you know, even across party lines, although there are distinctions, is higher taxes on the rich and corporations. It's not like this is a politically marginal position. As Bill said, it's not exactly anything that's about to zoom through Congress, not the current Congress anyway, because of the way the members of Congress get elected. A pittance for a billionaire to, you know, buy a Congress member or a senator or two or three, and we're stuck with that.
So I'm looking at the article that you referenced, McCurry, that you said you wanted to talk about from Kuttner's piece. And I completely agree with Kuttner with what he says. He says media commentators are mystified about why Joe Biden has not gotten more credit for an improved economy. With inflation down nearly to pre-pandemic levels and job creation setting records, the reason is not hard to grasp. Now, this is the operative line. None of the recent improvements have altered the basic situation of most Americans. Can I repeat that sentence again? None of the recent improvements have altered the basic situation of most Americans, in which reliable careers are scarce, college requires the burden of debt, health coverage is more expensive and less reliable, and housing is unaffordable. I mean, that's the billboard, Bill Curry, right there. I've been screaming that and screaming that over and over again, like unbelievable. And I want to go back to what Harold just said about that Wall Street Journal editorial. I got my finger down my throat about the poor rich that are spending so much in taxes. And Bill, we almost need to do this. So let's say we got all these billionaires, and I'm going to let's do a flat tax. I'm going to do 10% on a billionaire and a 10% on the shrinking middle class, okay? So let's say the shrinking middle class is making, we'll make a number up, we'll make it easy, $10,000, and the billionaire is making $10 million. 10% of 10 million is a hell of a lot of money compared to 10% of 10,000. But if we've got so many people that are now in the billionaire class, of course they're cutting more and more in the way of checks to the federal government because they control all of our damn wealth. I mean, it's almost like we have to go through the simple math to explain to people this is why they're paying, because what do we know? That's where the cash is. And if that's where the cash is, guess what? Fork it up, honey bun.
Even in articles that attempt to answer that argument about the rich paying so much more in taxes, usually forget to include in state and local taxes,
yes,
which are extraordinarily regressive. And when you actually look at the entire public sector budget, state, local, and federal. You may remember Mitt Romney in 2012 saying that 47% of the American people really weren't paying any taxes because he left out the FICA tax, which is a majority of everybody's federal tax.
Exactly.
And he also left out state taxes and local taxes. And he said that gave them no incentive. I forget whether it was to better themselves or to be better citizens and vote for him. But the truth is that all the people he was talking about paid a much higher rate of taxes than he did.
Yes.
And that it was his class of people who lacked the incentive to fix anything. And that's why, you know, you have Elon Musk ready to go to Mars and all these billionaires building basement fortresses in their homes and you know, buying land in New Zealand. They're just planning to bail. They're not dedicated to climate change. They're not dedicated to public health. They're not dedicated to public education. They've taken each man for himself to its ultimate extreme, which is where we are right now. And I'll just say a note about education. That is that we have this sort of metaphorical approach in, you know, almost, but we say that Americans have to be better workers. And Clinton, people I worked with, you know, would say this all the time. It's in an ever-changing world economy. We have to be constantly updating our skills. And Americans are lower in math scores, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They're not good workers. We have to use our education system essentially as an apprenticeship system to make them better workers. And the truth always was that we're great workers. We're the most productive. We work the longest out. We work like dogs.
Right.
And we produce more than anybody. We're terrible citizens. We're not bad workers. We're terrible citizens. We keep allowing our government to make political choices that cause our own suffering. And if only you stopped in education and realized that what we're trying to really do, the original goal of the Common School of Jefferson, Horace Mann, and John Dewey, and everybody else who ever had a valuable thought about it, is that we're making well-rounded human beings who will be better citizens. And you hardly ever even hear that mentioned as an objective. If we had just made three or four political choices differently in the last 30 years, if we hadn't voted down the public option and authorized the Iraq war, we'd just done those two things. I could list 30, but if we just done those two things, what a different world we'd be living in.
Harold, I'll let you sort of finish up in response to Bill, but I need to move to the other huge issue about what's going on in Gaza, because I have to talk about it. I can't avoid it. But do you want to respond to Bill before we move on?
Oh, I think Bill was quite eloquent. We can move on.
Okay, so I have a friend who, and I was putting up the graph from the New York Times from the other day showing the number of aid workers that have been killed. And they went back 20 or 30 years and they showed the number, and the number has just exploded when it came to what's going on in Gaza. I mean, the numbers don't even come close, but the number of aid workers. And I have been obviously very, very concerned about what Biden is doing vis-a-vis the war in Hamas. So one of my great sort of listeners and readers sent me this note, and he wrote, "Got to tell you, Arnie, I really am having a hard time being restrained about Biden. I know the alternative is Trump, but he's still sending bombs to Israel after the World Central Kitchen murders. Any guidance you can offer to keep restrained would be appreciated. I'm not sure how long I can even try to be restrained. Biden is incredibly horrible when it's coming to this. I know Trump is worse, but in any other year, I just wouldn't be able to fall in line. I just need to vent, but Biden is making it so, so hard. He really has to back off the bombs to Israel soon. I really want to attack him, but I'm so worried about November, I don't know what to do." I'm getting so much response. People are, they're torn about what to do. They were able to sort of express themselves in the primary, but that they're not sure that that's enough. And this is what I responded. I wrote, "I don't disagree. I am furious with Biden. But I'm looking at all the lives that we lost with Trump, and that includes Palestinians. You have to start counting the bodies now, Bob." That's how frustrated I am as well, Harold.
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember a time when American policy on a major issue was so completely incoherent. I wrote briefly about this, what I wrote was, I remembered an early algebra problem I once had in which a tub was being filled with water at a certain rate, but the drain was open and it was being drained at a certain rate. And we were supposed to calculate, you know, something or other based on that. On the one hand, that seems to me a perfect metaphor for what we're doing. We are sending, there was a recent story that we're sending even 2,000-pound bombs, which are designed to kill large numbers of people in a large area, to Israel. This is just in the past week. At the same time, we are urging Israel not to use large bombs, sending the means of destruction, and we're trying to send food. You know, this is a completely incoherent, ridiculous policy. And yeah, I mean, I don't know what the people around Biden, who are very seasoned political operatives, are thinking. This is obviously, you know, a huge political detriment. And there are many people like your friend Bob are furious at this, but don't really see an alternative. And, you know, what this could, you know, in terms of getting young people to vote for Biden, this is a disaster. I mean, it's obviously a disaster for people who are unfortunate enough to be living in Gaza right now, and unfortunate for anyone trying to help by going into Gaza, like the Seven World Kitchen employees who were killed. It's an absolutely absurd policy. One more point. In his interactions with Netanyahu, I'm reminded of Biden's interactions earlier on with Joe Manchin, in which Manchin seemed to be waltzing Biden around. And Netanyahu, you know, he listens to Biden and then goes ahead and does what he does anyway. You know, this is not exactly a stellar moment of presidential leadership. And it's just, A, it's outrageous, but B, it's bewildering.
It's more than confusion, Harold, and like, what is the message? Like, what are we saying? And let me just say something. So, Bill, it means I don't trust what Biden is saying. On one hand, he's talking about, you know, we need to tap down, we need to figure out how to get the food in, we're going to be building piers, and we're going to be doing all this stuff. And he expresses all this concern about this incredible death happening in Gaza and the people starving to death. And then, as you just mentioned, he's delivering these huge bombs. And I am listening to this split screen, and it says, not only is it a split screen, what is this that you think that I trust anything you say? because you're saying one thing verbally, but your actions are ultimately undermining that. And if that applies to what you're doing right now in Gaza, then tell me how I learned to trust you in other things. I think he has to understand this isn't just about the Palestinian issue. I begin to say, so are you placating me? Are you making me feel good about this? But if you're doing this and I'm looking at the bombs you're delivering, then I have to start questioning everything coming out of your mouth. He has to understand this is not good, not only for his leadership, but for the sense of trust.
Arnie, you and I were on a text thread with some fellow progressives at the beginning of all this. And I remember I wrote simply that we had to insist that not only the expansion and the harassment end among the Israeli settlers Palestinians, but that we actually insist that the settlements be drawn back. We've always said before withdrawing them, but we never do anything about it, is exactly as Harold said. And even progressives we were talking to weren't sure you could say that out loud yet, you can now.
Exactly.
And there's nothing you can't say that is reasonable on this topic. But you're absolutely right, Biden. It's partly an old hobby horse of mine, but it's the Democrats' fixation with message over policy, rather than fix a bad policy. They try to find a better way to describe it, and it seems that that's what the White House is doing with Israel right now. You have to act. We ourselves are guilty of great complicity in a policy that serves no one, neither Israeli nor Palestinian, truly in the end. And so we have to get up, if we want to be heard, and do two things. One, acknowledge that we should have gotten up a long time ago.
Yes.
We've been for a two-state solution, but when Biden says two-state solution right now, no one hears him, because we've been saying that for 25 years without meaning it, and everybody who cares knows it. And so you have to acknowledge what you've been doing. And then, number two, you have to take a specific concrete action that shows that you do mean it now. And there are a number of those they could begin to take, or at least articulate that this is a road, our arming you to conduct this kind of war and to approach this problem without a commitment to a two-state solution. Both those things. It's not just the mass murder. It's the objective. If you're not committed to the policy goal we supposedly shared as nations for over half a century, if you don't begin to truly commit to that, we can't support that policy militarily, because it violates the very DNA of our country, which is self-governance. It's the Boston Tea Party and the Declaration of Independence. And so Israeli security and Palestinian self-determination have to be co-equal goals, and they haven't been. And we have to now say out loud what we've done wrong, change it clearly, let people know we mean it, and begin taking actual action.
It's got to be more than words, Harold. It's just got to be more than words. I'm out of my mind. And what Bill mentioned about the West Bank and the illegal settlements, ask Stephanie what I talked to her about just before you guys came on. I was talking about the fact that when we stopped, when we said, oh, no more settlers, and did nothing, words are cheap, Harold.
They are. And some words that I think were particularly valuable, though, were in Chuck Schumer's speech. Calling for a new election was nice. But what he really did, and this was sort of underplayed, was he said, we're at a time when it looks like maybe we should move from unconditional aid to Israel to conditional aid for Israel. Yes. I mean, my God, that should be the kind of thing that Biden is moving to, as well as simply recognizing the Palestinian Authority, flawed as it is, as a state. There are things that can be done, none of which are being done.
I need to thank both Bill Curry and Harold Meyerson. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We'll schmooze on Monday. Everyone, thank you.